right, let's get started. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming back for another reading meeting with Mark and Molly, taking time out of your Sundays to listen to us have a fun little conversation with somebody who's doing some interesting things, thinking some smart things, having some good ideas, and we're excited.
How are you doing, Molly? I haven't seen you since maybe the last one of these.
I know. I'm good. I'm excited about the spring. I can see the buds on the trees. We're having the classic Wisconsin spring where suddenly it was green overnight. So I think there's a risk of snow on Tuesday.
Yeah. I'm doing okay, except I'm having a bad hair day. I feel like this camera is like not good for my hair. But
yeah. Well, we could get you a hat or a toupee or something.
Yeah.
I think it goes with being a scientist. No?
But you have bad hair? Yes. No question. No, mine was always this way. Anyway, you mean it makes me look like academic?
Extra smart. All you need is like a blazer with the elbow pads, you know?
I haven't had one of those since I was 12. All right. We have things to discuss today. We have a great session plan. And our guest is Margaret Goldberg, who is with the Oakland Unified School District and is an educator par excellence who has been engaged in many activities related to reading, teaching readings, about teaching teachers about reading, coaching, figuring out what good coaching practices are, thinking about how to use curricula effectively. She's developed curricula. She's developed materials for various projects. She has her hands in, she's a hands-on person at all levels. And many of you may know her through her posts that are on Reading Rockets and elsewhere. And so she has tons of expertise and insight about reading, teaching, and the intersection between research and practice. Margaret, and tell us, what are you doing this year?
So I teach first grade, and it's been remote only, but kids are coming tomorrow. We're starting hybrid instruction. So
yes, we're enormously grateful that you are actually able to participate during this crunch time. And thanks for being here. So Margaret, what should we talk about? We're going to talk about curricula and how to be sort of a critical user of them. But I know from other discussions with you and other things that you've written, you're certainly someone who thinks that research about how children learn and how reading works is relevant to instruction. It's relevant to using curricular materials intelligently, critically. But some people I think are losing the thread about the connections between research and practice, like, well, you know, the research is general and it's in a laboratory and it's kind of up in the air, whereas my problems are everyday ones. I have kids to teach. What can you say about, so what difference does it make that there's research about basic elements of reading and how children learn to read to you as someone who teaches teachers and who is also in a classroom this year trying to help little kiddos learn to read under difficult conditions? So is it relevant or not?
It's totally relevant. I think one of the things that I've noticed is that this year, where I have strong curriculum and strong knowledge and what needs to be done, it's been fine in remote instruction even, right? Like my kids have learned how to read words and they've done it via Zoom. But where things are a little bit hazier for me, where I have less in the way of curricular support or less in the way of my own knowledge of how I should be approaching things, that's where it's a little looser around the edges and the outcomes for kids show it. So I think if anything, this has been a testament to how important teacher knowledge and high quality materials are, because when we have a game plan, then it doesn't, I mean, there can be a global pandemic and we can still figure out how to teach them effectively. So, yes.
So one thing is, so in at least some areas, maybe not every, can you just expand on that a little bit? I mean, it's sort of like, okay, I learned things about, there's things, knowledge that you acquired about things that are relevant to helping your kids make progress. And just maybe there's some areas where it could be that your knowledge is lacking. It could also be that the research is less clear. But can you get a little bit more specific about how it actually translates into things, this knowledge translates into things that made a difference, make a difference for your kids?
Well, I think probably the best way to explain it is to kind of back up and explain how I got to this point of deciding that I needed to try to apply everything that I had learned to my own kids in my own classroom. In theory, I was supposed to be in a classroom all year this year, not in my mother-in-law unit downstairs teaching via Zoom. But anyways, the way that I got to this point was that I had been hired as a reading interventionist and a coach at a failing school. So literally between 2.5% and 3% of the kids were proficient on state reading tests. So it was failing. And I was supposed to go in to try to help the school scoop up the district's balanced literacy initiative. So my goal was supposed to be to help them implement the curriculum that had been purchased, and then to implement the intervention curriculum that had been purchased with small groups of first graders. And so I was doing that and failing miserably. So I was realizing that these practices I had understood from my high performing school, when I had been a classroom teacher at a school that was, you know, upwards of 70% proficient, I was bringing those practices over to a school that was failing, expecting that if the kids just had more time to read, if the kids had the joy of reading and a big library and all of this stuff, that the magic was going to happen and the kids were going to get it. And instead, you know, they were throwing books and stuff, everything that you would expect for kids who are confronted with a struggle for long periods of time, every day, day after day. So I knew it wasn't working. And I knew as I was talking to the kids, I would go up to them and be like, what's going on for you? Have you started reading your book? What's happening? And just in those conversations, they told me over and over again in different ways that what made reading hard was the words. And I realized that we weren't doing anything really to help them learn how to read the words that were on the page. And there was some curriculum on the shelf that was dusty that had been purchased years ago as part of a grant that people had lost focus on. It was for teaching kids how to decode. So I pulled that program off the shelf and I was teaching two small groups or several groups of students, but with these two separate approaches simultaneously. And I started realizing that what I was doing with each one of the groups, it was completely different. So the way that I was telling them to approach books was different. The books I was giving them were different. The structure of the lessons were different. Like everything was different. And I was trying to figure out, well, what's the research base on which these programs rest? So I started looking up the reading research that was cited in the front matters of the programs. And what I ended up finding is that I was teaching on both sides of the reading war. So I was teaching the like whole language-y balanced literacy side to some students, and I was teaching the like phonics skills-focused side to other sets of students. And I guess I hadn't really realized that that debate should have ended and that I didn't need to be in the position that I was in. I just kept going through articles after article where it was like they had come to realize that kids actually do need to learn how to read the words on the page, and that all of these strategies that we have for teaching them to avoid having to do that are moribund, and I needed to stop doing them. And I think it took probably like probably like 3 or 4 months, I guess, of like staying up late at night trying to figure out how to read these scientific articles. Like I have a memory of reading a Seidenberg and McClellan article and nearly dying. So it's like, what is this saying? I know it's important, but I don't know how to make sense of it. What should I do? And I was like, okay, I'm going to try to figure out how to read this. Thank God I knew like that there's the abstract and there's the conclusion. And if I read those first, then I can try to make sense of the middle. But that's not something I had been taught to do in teacher prep. And so I felt like I was now backfilling a whole lot of knowledge that had been, I felt like it had been withheld from me. And that's the reason why I was being put in the position of trying to do something that would never work for kids. How does that feel?
Well, were you figuring things out on your own in the backfilling that you were doing. You know, a lot of discussion we've had has been about, you know, what's the on-ramp? It seems all this seems forbidding. I certainly wouldn't send somebody immediately to our old Seidenberg McClellan paper, but that was very.
You're a real go-getter.
That was great. But seriously, so you found reliable sources. You've read what everyone copied, what you did.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. The way I approached things was not a very efficient way to do it. I literally got to the point where I was like, I'm hearing one camp saying these things and here are all the names, and I'm hearing this other camp say these things and here are all the names. And then there's some people that everybody seems to cite and they're like in the middle. I'm like trying to draw this Venn diagram, and it wasn't until I realized, like, I'm looking at it, I'm like, that's the reading wars. Like, I remember hearing about those, and I was able to see them and see that it was still happening. But I actually kind of made a promise that nobody should have to do what I did, which was go in so blindly and just try to make sense of it. So what ended up happening was I met a founder of a project that was focused on improving kindergarten readiness. And she wanted to expand the program to help eliminate the third grade reading achievement gap. So she had lots of money and understood the National Early Literacy Panel, had read the National Reading Panel, and wanted to try to get instruction in our school district aligned with the research. And so I started showing her the curriculum that we were using, and she was able to see that it wasn't going to get us there. She understood why. And so we put in place this grant-funded project that I was leading for a few years to try to help site-based literacy coaches understand their reading research, what it says about instruction, and then present that to teachers in a way that was a good use of their time so that they weren't staying up late drawing Venn diagrams with names on both sides, that they were actually just like in PD during paid hours, making sense of the evidence base and then what the instructional implications were as a result of it.
Just asking, you know, there's professional development programs out there that last, you know, that vary in their scope and detail. And I'm wondering, how much time could you spend with teachers to get benefits? It wasn't a 2-year long course, I assume.
No. So I think one of the things that I realized is how difficult large scale change is. So we had a site-based person at each one of 15 low performing schools. They were there ranged from 50% time to full time, depending on the number of students at the school and the number of classroom teachers. And then I had them for PD, these coaches, every other week. I had them and their principal for PD once a month. They had PD with their teachers on an ongoing basis, at least one per month focused on early literacy. Like, it took all of that to get to the point where teachers started to have their fingertips on some really important findings, where they were able to start looking critically at the current initiative and then also think through what would be a better path forward for their students. And one of the things that was really helpful was giving coaches the grounding in the reading research and then helping them to be able to see how it shows up in the curriculum. So we would, go ahead.
Yeah. No, sorry, I'm terrible. Go ahead.
No, you should go. We're talking. It's
well,
your like, turn.
Well, so for example, listen, that sounds, I know that was a lot of work and a lot of effort and commitment on everyone's part. And I really like hearing about the, you know, principals being involved and so on, but that's not a huge amount of time compared to something. So, and I'm helpful that's okay, because it can be focused and effective if you hit exactly the right kinds of stuff. But can you just sort of give an example of the things that people could then apply critically to their own materials and their own practices, having talked and learned about stuff?
Yeah, well, so this is the one I know you and I have talked about this before, and you have some doubts about its importance, but the four-part processing system was very helpful, and I know you have some reservations about it, but to be able to see that model of reading compared to the three cueing model, which is what we had been working with, and to be able to understand that what we're trying to do is not orchestrate a variety of different strategies to come to recognize what a word is, but that focus on getting kids to be effortless in their decoding and then apply their language comprehension to what they had read. Seeing those two models, it was like a huge light bulb went off. And then we were able to start looking at curricular materials and be able to see, well, what is the theory of reading behind this program that we're attempting to teach? And we realized that anytime we were finding 3Qing or MSV analysis in curriculum, it was likely to be ineffective for our students. And we were getting really good at being able to spot it in our materials and to be able to explain clearly why it wasn't going to get us the skilled readers that we were hoping for in the primary grades. That was the biggest shift.
So that sounds like a case in which you were able to like use research to say something about what's not going to work. And you know, I think we agree that this is like, this is an important thing. It's not everything, but merely guiding people away from practices that we know are really off track for very well-established sort of reasons. That itself can be positive, even if it doesn't answer all the other questions about what's left to do. I mean, that's sort of how you view it, isn't it?
I've definitely seen that there are things that we should stop immediately, like any of the guessing at words, any of the like time-consuming assessments that treat each reader as an individual who then needs to be analyzed and get a custom-tailored lesson, like anything that we're doing that is so hyper-focused on an extreme amount of differentiation is generally guiding us in the direction of a lot of independent work. So a lot of kids being without guidance for long periods of time. It also becomes a really big burden for the teacher. It feels completely overwhelming to have to plan from scratch all of the things that you're going to be doing, which makes it so that you're more likely to have dead time or less effective lessons because you just didn't get a chance to create them from scratch. So we started to notice that if we were able to understand that every child basically learns how to read in the same way, the functioning of the brain is the same, and the English code is the same, and we're just trying to get those to match up, and we're looking at where in the development the child is so that we're able to target the instruction to that point. That's the level of differentiation that's necessary. And yeah, that was a huge burden lifted, huge.
Yeah, no, I think this is a really, really sweet point. I mean,
right, this idea of what differentiation means.
Yeah, I mean, you can talk about it in terms of, look, the research gives us like a dozen or so really important ideas about essential things that happen in development and moving into reading. And those are dimensions that relate to each other. And then there's how they relate over time as the kids learns more. But so, you know, the issue is, and then you can use a relatively small number of dimensions as the focus of instruction and looking at differences between curricula and also assessment, like, tracking where the kid is at. My problem with the five pillars is that it's out of date and that people are relying on it too much. They take like it too checklist. Literacy. They take mm-hmm. it too literally. And so you can literally have programs in which those fluency, for example, or each of these things is taken as a component of reading. And I think that really is goes way beyond what that review of the literature allows. But I understand the eye opening that happens when people encounter these first sort of ideas that really reorient them. Mm-hmm. So I want to make it clear, it's kind of just what it's being used for is really the problem to me.
Well, and how deep the knowledge is underneath it. Like when I had understood the five pillars leaving teacher prep, I was like, oh, you're supposed to have all of those five things in your curriculum. As long as they've checked the box for those five things, you're good to go. Go ahead and either teach that program or make up your own program where you're addressing those five components. But I think it was really eye-opening for me to be able to find out like that fluency, this characteristic of skilled reading, is very different than phonics, which is this instructional approach that we need to be using, which is very different than comprehension, which is our goal, like the whole reason why we're doing all of these things. And I think really being able to understand that these things are not apples to apples and that you have to understand each one of those five pillars and realize that they have to be integrated in your instruction, like your phonics and phonological awareness instruction. The goal of it is for improved decoding, which goal is fluency, and then on to comprehension. I think it's weaving those things together instead of treating them separate.
Absolutely. And so I think we owe people a successor to the five pillars. And basically, there's quite a lot more.
Is that the royal we? Will you do it?
I'll do it if you'll do it. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, this is the hard thing about all of these simple models that bring people in and are great illustrators of the points, you know, the four-part process or the simple view of reading. If you just stop there and you don't
continue
learning and deepening your knowledge of those things, that's where we talk about having concerns. If you just label the five pillars, the underlying developmental model. I think that the point that Margaret was bringing up of like thinking about where the kid is in development and thinking about it, I mean, this as a developmental issue and thinking about where they are, assessing it that way, not assessing it as a, where are they on these sub-skill component skills, but where are they in their development towards getting to the fluency and the comprehension? Mm-hmm. And so then once you know where they are, then you can think about, okay, now what do I know needs to happen to improve that?
Yeah, I think, so if I'm repeating what you're saying, we've made the point that except in some very unusual, atypical cases, reading's basically working the same way for kids, but they're not all moving ahead on the trajectory in exactly the same way. So, you know, everybody's got to learn essentially the same things. And we need to be more sophisticated than the five pillars. But not so detailed that it's, you know, at the level of the things that I see people arguing about a lot, which I think are often at a much finer grain, you know, something that maybe is a little academic. And really, when I see arguments now, because, you know, wars continue, I ask, like, is the resolution of who's this argument for? Is the resolution of this actually going to have an impact on the child or not? Or are these things existing for other people's, you know, entertainment or something? The thing is, we could actually have a much better guidelines that are based on a better accounting of what we've learned since in the past 20 years, for sure. So there's things not to do. There's also kind of getting oriented towards what the major goals are. And did you feel like you were explaining to teachers, you know, not only what to do, but why?
Oh, totally. And I think that's the biggest piece that's missing, because I don't think I've ever met a teacher who doesn't teach phonics in the primary grades. I don't think I've ever met a teacher who doesn't think that fluency is important to reading. Like, every teacher feels like that box has been checked. But when you actually go in and you watch the instruction that's happening, you don't necessarily see kids benefiting from the teacher's hard work and focus. So for example, when we started looking at materials and we were realizing that in a lot of instances, teachers have been trained to be so afraid of teaching foundational skills to the point of mastery that they're given programs to like jazz things up as much as possible to make them fun. So we were looking, the coaches that I was supporting and I were looking at this lesson where the teacher is supposed to take two different colors of paint and mix the paints together and then explain that that's like a blend. So one color is like s and the other color is like t, and then you put those together and we're like, but hold on, that wouldn't even be a blend. That's a digraph. Like, it became this whole new color. Like, and why are we mixing paint during a phonics lesson? Like, is it because we're so afraid that phonics is so boring for kids that we need to bring in all of this stuff to jazz it up? And then we started realizing, like, if we get straight to the point and explain things in a very efficient, effective, clear, concise way, and kids see the relevance of that to their reading, then there's no boredom in sight. Like, I think the biggest problem is teacher boredom, not kid boredom, when it comes to learning foundational skills.
I also think that we could work harder together on materials that are doing more than one thing at a time. So for example, phonemic awareness, you know, phonemic awareness is something that kids who are learning to read, succeeding at reading alphabetic writing systems definitely develop. However, you know, the amount that needs to be taught, how that knowledge develops and so on is a different question. But say that you're doing activities that are related to building the kids' phonemic awareness. Well, how are you doing it? You're doing it in the context of tasks like, you know, identifying whether the sounds at the ends of the words are the same or not, or whether they have the same vowel or other things of that sort. That activity can be done in the context of words mm-hmm. or other things. Mm-hmm. It can be done in a way that you're on the one hand teaching them about phonemes and trying to build that phonemic awareness sort of implicit knowledge. But at the same time, you're also giving them a lesson about words and about the particular items that you're using. You can also, because, you know, phonemes are parts of words, and words have syllables and morphemes and that have meaning, et cetera, so that, you know, on the one hand, you do want to get to phonemic awareness. On the other hand, it can be done in ways that are also taking advantage of the fact that phonemes are related to other things the kids need to learn. So you can learn more than the effect of the learning experiences on more than one thing at a time. It seems to me that would make it less boring.
Less boring and more clear to kids why they're learning the thing that they're learning, which makes it less boring, right? So there's a cycle with that. But I'm thinking about the other day. So we're deep in this unit about birds with my first graders. And so they're all supposed to be writing about the different beaks that birds have and why they use them. And so they're writing, and one kid presses the unmute button because we're on Zoom. And she's like, "Miss Goldberg, which E in beaks?" And I was like, so brilliant, right? Like, for the kid to be able to know, I know it's E blank E, or I know it's EE or EA, just tell me which one and I'll write it. But that was that moment of phonemic awareness where it was being applied to the kid's purpose. Yeah. And I think about sometimes when we drill things separately, I don't think we make it clear enough to kids what they should be doing to integrate that into their regular reading and writing experience. And for some kids, it comes really easily. For other kids, like, we actually need to explain that in our instructional routines, making sure that they're understanding how these little pieces are coming together for a cohesive reading and writing experience.
So yeah, so I really agree with you. The thing is, so this plays to one of my real concerns, which is that, you know, if you look at research, you find that there are certain components of reading, and then they're going to get taught. And, you know, if you teach them independently, you're losing the fact that they're related to one another. And you also get into a mentality of teaching all of these skills, like phonemic awareness or phonological awareness or fluency, anything. I mean, vocabulary, all of these things are measured by having kids do various tasks. And we become more focused on the tasks that, for example, demonstrate phonemic awareness than we do on the fact that, well, the kid is only learning this stuff in the service of another goal. It's not for its own sake.
Right.
It's so that they can read. And I feel I feel like this idea that you have to master each of these things because research says they're important kind of misses the idea that the kid is learning these things in the service of reading. It's only beneficial if it's actually advancing the kid's ability to recognize and understand words and ultimately sequences of words and texts. And, you know,
But here's where it gets tricky. So you and I think, and Molly, and everybody else, seem to be aligned on this idea that you're learning these, kids are learning these discrete skills in order to be able to integrate them for the larger purpose of being able to read and write. But the problem is that teachers are given so many materials that put it all together in this mismatch, so that the teacher's in the position of saying, like, I am teaching vocabulary, phonological awareness, phonics, fluency, and comprehension. I'm doing it in my 15-minute guided reading lesson with this predictable book that came to me in this packaged curriculum. That means that I'm teaching reading in a holistic way that is more aligned with the researcher, Mark Seidenberg. So be careful.
I understand. This is really, really why clarity and following up on these issues and being as clear as possible, clear that one can be in one of these conversations, but we can get started, is critical. I do hear you, exactly. So, you know, there's under teaching, right? There's not teaching. For a long time, you know, we had the problem of not teaching kids things that most kids need to be taught about print and sound and these things I think of as basic skills. There wasn't enough of that. It was assumed the kid would kind of catch on if he created the right kind of environment. But there's also the possibility of overteaching. There's the possibility of setting some standard for how much to do that every kid's got to get to, independently of what's going on with their reading. Mm-hmm. And so I understand what we're saying here is that all of these things that seem reasonable can also be kind of planned a different way. And really being precise about it, I think is the challenge because much more could be done in terms of, you know, spelling out activities that have the right character, that aren't just sort of, that are really integrating these things well. But I definitely appreciate the problem. You can do it too little, you can do it too much. You can do things independently, but then that chops things up into parts and makes it, you know, harder to understand makes it less efficient. But then you can say, you can mash it all together and say, well, I do this all at once because I have two kids who focus on meaning. And we really have to get past the slogans to being more specific about exactly what's what. I mean, do you think there is a dosage issue here that still kind of needs to be addressed? Like, how much is enough?
Yeah, I do, because here's the thing. Like, so I have a group of 26 first graders. They are all making really great gains in their reading, except for the ones who have been absent too much this year. But other than that, I'm very pleased with their progress. But the dosage that these groups of students need, it's different. So for some kids, the amount of foundational skills instruction that they need, they just need it a little bit, and then they need a whole bunch of application, and they're off and running. And then for other kids, they need a much bigger dose and a lot more repetitions in order to be able to get the same concepts nailed. So like, I think about this with kids learning to read words that end with final E, like they're reading make and bake. And for some kids, the second you show it to them, they're totally fine. And for other kids, the process of having to look at the end of the word in order to be able to start reading the word from left to right, it's just like completely befuddling. It takes so much practice to get to the point where they're able to notice that. And I think one of the things that was really helpful for me from the reading research is to realize that's totally fine. Like, it's completely okay for there to be a differing amount of dosage needed for a variety of different kids. And that it's on me to be able to give the right dosage to the child. So I'm monitoring their progress using mastery tests to be able to make sure that they're getting the right amount. And I think too often what happens is that we're given curricular materials that don't allow us to vary the dosage. So the idea is that all kids are supposed to get like 15 to 20 minutes of word work, and that's going to be enough for them to be able to crack the alphabetic code. And it's just not the case. And so then teachers are in this position of feeling, well, there must be something wrong with the kids. Like, I did all the word work and they're not catching on. That's the process where we need to put in a referral for SPED testing or something. And the answer is no. If we expect reading difficulty to be natural, and if we're prepared to be able to give the amount of repetition the child needs, you feel really strong and powerful as a teacher being able to see the progress.
Yes. I mean, so
relates to somebody. Somebody had a question early on that was like, she was like, I work in a small independent school district, school where they're really Calkins and FNP steeped in it. And when the students aren't successful, they focus on trying to figure out what's wrong with the student and don't have a conversation about the curriculum and the instruction. And she was asking if you had any suggestions for taking some baby steps forward. And maybe one of the things you're suggesting here is thinking about even just thinking about the dosage issue. It's not necessarily even the curriculum. I mean, yes, there could be concerns with there are some bad practices that need to be thrown out, but maybe also some yeah, some refocusing on that.
Dose. Yeah, I think if like there's a way for us to be able to look at the program and look at our instructional minutes, look at how we're approaching teaching, and to be able to say what are our assumptions about what kids are supposed to be capable of. So we're assuming that they should be able to pick this thing up because we have given it to them how many times this information, how much practice are they getting, how much opportunity for application are they getting. If we're able to look at it, I think a lot of times we'll see that we're erring on the side of the kids who need very little out of school. We're erring on the side of kids who can pick it up easily. And one of the things that I was trying to explore was to find out why is it that teachers are so leaning towards the side of light touch instruction. And I think part of it is the way that we're trained to do the job. Part of it is the materials. And part of it is because of who we are. Like, we tended to do well in school. We tended to not get a whole lot of explicit instruction, and we turned out fine. So we're trying to replicate for kids what was good enough for us without realizing we're not a representative sample of kids in school.
No, we are not. And so tell me if you think this is fair characterization. I mean, I feel like there are some children for whom what happens in the classroom makes almost very little difference.
Yeah.
They have other resources available to them for whatever reasons, but usually it's because there are other resources and there's other time on task outside of school and so on. And when we're looking at kids who are struggling, there could be a variety of reasons, but one of them is they don't have access to the same kind of resources in the home and community. And so they don't end up having as much time on task. We can't just gauge ourselves whether we're being successful based on the fact that there's some kids who are going to learn regardless of what we do for a variety of reasons that have nothing to do with, you know, curriculum and instruction. I've been trying to, I have a paper that's coming up, which we try to talk about, you know, thinking a little bit more different. Thinking a little bit differently about developmental trajectories. That is, you know, how much we have these milestones for kids, you know, end of third grade, you should be able to, you know, understand basic skills and be able to, you're gaining the ability to read more independently and figure things out on your own, et cetera, with less supervision and so on. There may be kids who need more time. They may need more time because their circumstances are different. Maybe they're an English language learner or something. Maybe there's some other conditions. I guess my point is each kid needs the amount of time they need. Each kid needs the amount of phonics that they need given how they're progressing towards the real goal, which is reading, comprehension, writing, and spelling, and so on. And so, I'm concerned that on the one hand, you could say, yeah, this child needs more time on task. They need more opportunities to learn. That too can be, you know, slanted in a way that's in an unintentional way, which is like, if you say, well, some kids need more time to gain these basic skills because they're still learning English or something like that, it becomes an excuse for they're not having made much progress. And so then
the thing, I wouldn't say that it's about time. I always use the term dosage. So it's my responsibility to get them to the same point at the end of my grade level. So I need to get my kiddos ready for second grade. And so that means some of my kids get a double dose because that's what they need. And so when I'm thinking about the amount of time, I'm not saying like, oh, they haven't got it yet, but they'll catch on. Like, it'll come to them later. They just need more time to learn how to read. What I'm thinking about is how do I maximize my instructional time and spend it in the places that are most needed?
Yes, that's a better way to put it. I mean, it's you know, opportunities to learn is enough learning opportunities, and some kids will need more, and some kids are indeed moving ahead to other things. And mm-hmm. and it would be a mistake to sort of hold either of them to a fixed sort of timetable or standard, I would think. What about curriculum? So can I just press on this point for just one second?
Because sure, if I can.
If I say something that's really wrong, and get corrected, that that's actually a very informative moment. So my view is that there isn't any one size fits all dosage, that the component skills and how the kid is progressing isn't against a fixed standard, 85% are correct, or ability to identify every one of the so-called 44 phonemes of English on a certain kind of task. The criterion is something like, these are the things, components, yes, and they need instruction in the amount of instruction they need in them is always against, is always determined with reference to where they are in the actual goal, which is reading as assessed in different ways, their ability to recognize words, their ability to figure out new words, to be able to pronounce things accurately, et cetera, et cetera. So what if one's, how radical would it be to say, the amount of instruction that you need for any of these component skills really has to be conditionalized on, it's really dependent on where the kid is in terms of their reading progress. If the child is making progress on these really core important things about reading accurately and fluently and with good comprehension, that means you can stop on some of these other things or pull back. So is that what everyone assumes, or is that bad?
I think that's true, but I would push a little bit to say that teachers need to have concrete data points to make that judgment rather than our just like observational data. So for example, if I were to look at my incoming first graders at the beginning of this year and say like, these are my readers who don't need so much from me, and these are the ones who do, and you know, if I had spread them out, I might have been right-ish, but because I actually had an objective test that I gave to them really quickly to find out what they knew and what they didn't know, all of a sudden I noticed some kids who are presenting as very strong readers had a whole lot of gaps. It helped to explain some of the things that were impacting their comprehension, their writing ability. There were all sorts of little things that I needed to fill in. And I think too often what we'll do is we'll assume that kids who have strong language skills must therefore have strong reading skills. And I notice this sometimes when teachers do like a reading record with kids or whatever. So the kid who's really chatty ends up scoring higher, and the kid who's not so chatty ends up scoring lower, because we think they're presenting themselves as a stronger reader. Yeah. And it's just not accurate data.
No, so your point is really, what I was saying before is only going to work if you have some actual information about how the child is progressing in
exactly.
The serious.
It's not your gut.
If you're kind of, no, and that your point.
And
about,
anything, you know, that's dependent on your gut, anything where like you're making your own curriculum based on your own gut reaction to how a child is doing in this formative assessment, like ends up steering you in really the wrong direction.
Yes, and that's not a criticism of teachers. As teachers, that's going to be true of lots of judgments that people make under these other people's behaviors and characteristics. I mean, they're just not that precise. But I think we haven't, hasn't everyone encountered the kid who's high verbal, but and makes you think they're making all this incredible progress in reading, but then when you actually, and they get away, you know, sort of get away with it. And indeed, if you're reading the same books over and over again, or you're not pushing the kid to the next level, they can kind of do a good imitation of being a reader for quite a long time.
Up till third grade in a lot of instances.
I think so. I've known some of those kids.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that was really helpful was when I started as a literacy coach at first, the narrative at my school was we in the primary grades, we've got it down. And it's in the upper grades that they're having a problem with their teaching because the kids are struggling in comprehension on the third grade and up reading tests. But we in the primary grades, we've got it down. And so I started doing assessments on the upper grade students and realized that we had very few students who knew the short vowel sounds, very few students who knew why a word would be, you know, hoping versus hopping or whatever it was. And it was taking so much bandwidth for them as they were doing this guessing and checking as they were reading that they were really struggling. And it was really interesting when we started taking the primary grade teachers and having them look at the data from their former students to be able to realize like those things that they needed to learn, they actually needed to learn when they were in our classrooms.
Yeah.
And we were feeling like they were making more progress because of the measurements that we were using, not because they were actually having that solid foundation that skilled readers need in order to progress further. And one of the things that struck me is how well the teachers responded to that information. Like I was feeling like I would have gone home and rocked in a ball and cried for forever if I found out that I had worked so hard year after year only to set my kids up to stumble and fall. And instead they were like, okay, well, we're gonna get it right this year for these kids who are in front of us. And the teachers who had a whole lot of guilty like voices in their head feeling bad, some of them started tutoring kids that they used to have in their classroom. So bringing the third graders down back to first grade classrooms after school for tutoring to fill in those gaps. And I think that's where I started to realize that when teachers have the knowledge, we absolutely have the enthusiasm and the drive to try to put it to use and to do right by kids. It's when we don't know that what we're doing isn't working that we continue to do the same things and get the same outcomes.
Yes, of course, absolutely.
So to explicitly kind of link this to our topic of today and like thinking about your curriculum, is this assessment piece a piece that's like a recommendation of yours that regardless of like the curriculum you're using, thinking about what assessment you're using, thinking about that critically is going
to be useful? Yeah, so I think one of the things that was most mind-blowing to me was to realize the importance of valid, predictive, reliable data. Like when I realized that we could find out if a kid was on the trajectory to reading success by looking at some really discrete points in kindergarten and first grade, my mind was blown. Like I had no idea that you could use data almost as like a crystal ball to see where a child would be ending up unless we change our course. And once I realized that there is a value to data that is strictly objective, and that what it does is we can cross-check with it. Like we tried this thing. Did it make a difference? Mm-hmm. Did we do this thing fully enough? Did it make a difference? Like once I started realizing that my attitude toward data had been wrong, I thought it was only to guide day-to-day instruction. Like you do a reading record and then decide the reading strategy to work on with your guided reading groups at that time. Or you do a reading record and decide what level book the kid should work on. I hadn't realized that it was actually helpful to have an external measure to see whether or not our tier one instruction was quality.
So,
mind-blowing.
Well, it feels like collecting data. I mean, the running record or the thing. I mean, that maybe feels like you have some data, you have something to go off of choosing how you're.
But it's so time consuming, right? Like every time you sit down to do those assessments, it's coming away from something else you could be doing.
Yes. And is it the data at the right level, you know, exactly. Right grain? I mean, to really be able to make these big judgments about how the kid is progressing. I mean, is it useful? I mean, and efficient. Could we transition into, I mean, so curricula, there are curricula obviously that come with built-in ways of assessing kids' progress. But you it sounds like you're suggesting that what you were thinking in terms of was some independent instruments, independent kinds of tools.
To assess kind of the efficacy of the curriculum, right? So what I realized was that we had gotten into this closed loop where the same publisher that was giving us our curriculum, was giving us our assessment, was also giving us our intervention program, and that we were just in this cycle. And because we were in that cycle based on that data, we had no other path forward to try to get kids out of intervention. And once I realized that if we had an external measure, we would be able to assess whether or not our classroom instruction was strong in these important areas. And if it wasn't, that we then needed to figure out what to do to it. Not to teach the test, but to figure out how to dive under the hood of our program.
Yeah. Yeah, good assessment tools are helpful. Bad assessment tools are, you know, a waste of time. So did you have, just asking, did you have to like, you know, look into it yourself or consult with other people to figure out what kinds of independence measures would be most helpful?
Yeah. So the first thing we had to do was to get a valid, predictive, reliable assessment that was completely separate from our curriculum in order to be able to gauge the quality of classroom instruction. Then we needed to be able to figure out, well, we understand that our narrative in failing schools often is kids come in low and they stay low. And actually, what we see when we look at data is kids may come in low and get lower. So what happens is that we're not closing the gap in the first few months of the primary grades, and we actually need to figure out a way to change the trajectory. So, and once we realized that was possible, it was like power, being given power.
Who is we, though? It sounds like you had to have lots of folks on board here to do this, and other people this may be a struggle or an issue for other people in other settings. So how did you, the principal has to be at, are we talking about individual schools or a set of schools that teachers were at, who you were coaching? Who had to be on board in order to share this insight that you had?
So for most of the work.
And somebody had to agree that there was a need here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was interesting
is that a lot of the teachers that I work with had experience using a assessment and just never seeing any growth on it. And so they discounted the assessment and instead started to realize, like, if we provide high quality instruction to students, we start noticing growth on an assessment that we had kind of tuned out. And then we started to realize, well, we need to think about why this is working. What about it is working? And we started to notice the explicit nature of instruction, the instructional routines, the amount of student practice, the amount of student opportunities to apply what they were learning. Like, all of that was the heart of high quality instruction. And what we noticed is in most of the materials that we had a whole lot of fluff. We had a whole lot of the like mixing paints together to explain what a blend is and very little of the kid actually getting a chance to use that for the purposes of reading and writing.
Yeah, that is so interesting and seems to me so articulate about, you know, what really is involved, right? The quality of the, I'm not gonna be able to repeat it back as well as you just said it in terms of, we record these things. No, but because in terms of the quality of the instruction and the amount of instruction and, opportunities to learn and practice. There's a practice element. It's not just send the kid off with a book, it's send the kid off and also being able to provide some kinds of feedback. So this leads us to, well, people typically are working with curricula that have been bought for their use and they're not going away anytime soon as far as anyone can tell. So
we have to learn how to get good at using it, right? Because it's given to us. And I feel like there are certain things that we can absolutely do. So the first thing that I learned was the thing I have to admit I was terrible about in my first few years of teaching, which is like I used to just open up the program to the first lesson and read the first lesson and then figure out what I was going to do with that lesson instead of reading the front matter of the program where they explain like the theory and research and approach to the program that it was grounded in. So once I started learning to read the front matter of programs, that's where I started to be able to realize that you can pick up really important words and phrases that let you know whether or not this program is likely to send you in the right direction. So like the program that I had been hired to coach to when I first joined my school district literally had language in there about how kids will magically learn how to read. And once I realized like, oh, that idea where they're going to role play their way into becoming readers, this is a huge red flag. Like this is a non-starter of our curriculum. There's nothing we can do with this that is going to get us there. And then I had other curriculum that was like, yes, it's this MSV thing, but really you should lean a lot on the V part. Reading is a visual process primarily. And if kids are taught how to visually recognize words, they'll be stronger. And I was like, okay, well, this is telling me that maybe there's something that could be of use in here, but really it's going to be really slow on the phonological awareness development or on the explicit phonics instruction, really. Like there's a whole lot of like flashcards in this program where kids are supposed to learn words based on sight. and this is going to be a problem for me. Like, I think I started to get better at being able to see if I know what their statement of how kids learn how to read is, then I know how to find the weaknesses and the scope and sequence and also the strengths that exist in the
program. Yeah. So it's learning to read between the lines and it's learning to interpret what they're. So you gained skill at this and you taught other people about it. Is this a public, are these materials or these are lessons that could be shared? I mean, should we be preparing like a user's guide to Fountas and Pinnell, or, you know, a user's guide to Wonders, you know, or something like that?
I think we could. So, and I know that some places have done that, like University of Oregon created a whole bunch of supplements for programs that they had reviewed. But I think, so yes, those, that work is absolutely necessary. And I think there's more of it needed. But I think when it comes to like the day-to-day experience of a literacy coach at a school site or district level leaders who are trying to figure out what curriculum they should be using and why, like when it comes to the individual practitioner in the absence of really strong reviews of curriculum, there's a couple of guiding questions that would be really helpful. And I feel like looking at the front matter, looking at a couple of sample lessons and being able to say, like, according to this lesson, what do the authors think that readers should do when they get to an unfamiliar word? What does this instruction expect of students? Like, what does it expect that English language learners are going to be able to do? What's the role of the teacher in this lesson? And then what if their students going to learn from this instruction? And what beliefs about reading development would create this lesson? Then we're starting to be able to look at the lesson and the program and kind of pull it apart and to be able to see if it's making a whole lot of assumptions of our kids and putting teachers into a small role of like facilitating or coaching or being a guide on the side. Like, that's not actually going to be the most explicit and direct instruction that the vast majority of students need in order to learn how to read well.
I do think, though, what you're describing really assumes that somebody's got an idea about what the better alternatives are and knows where what the red flags are. So, you know, you can learn to identify whether they emphasize guessing words based on context and less about learning how to actually, you know, read the word, decode the word. But the individual then has to know, well, and the implication of that is what? Well,
yep.
You'd have to know that it's not a great idea. It's a very laborious and it's the opposite of fluency. It's not a very effective way. It's not as effective as actually giving the kid the tools to recognize the word on their own, and so on. But it assumes that the person can not only identify the kind of red things in the curriculum the way you're talking about it, but also they have in mind, oh, they should have. It also needs to be this, or it needs to be this instead. In other words, people have some understanding of what the ideal is, what the alternative is. It seems like both parts are necessary to be able to like do this, what you're talking about.
There are checklists and stuff. So like, I know that there are lots of rubrics that are available for evaluating your curriculum to see how strong it is. But one of the things that I've realized is that if people haven't received the professional development to understand why that is on the rubric, then they're not able to accurately use the rubric. So we have to norm making sure that we understand that when the word explicit is here, this is what it actually means, instead of explicit meaning like, oh, well, I thought I was clear when I said that, which is often what we end up thinking about explicit instruction. So it's like knowing what's on the rubric, why it's on the rubric, and then how to use the rubric.
You know, Margaret, I feel like you have such a nice integrated worldview here that I wonder why the kinds of things that you've engaged in can't be scaled up in a big way. I mean,
there's a lot of people doing different types of things to try to help teachers. I think there hasn't been enough of a concerted effort to align all of those tactics. So I think there are people who are trying to develop curriculum, and there's people who are trying to do professional development, and people who do teacher prep, and people like all of these different little I shouldn't call them little, but like important efforts that because they are not aligned, teachers end up being in the position of having to navigate all this stuff by ourselves.
Yeah. Molly, do we have any questions that people really are burning questions that we could kind of take from people in the audience?
Well, everybody just wants to know what Margaret's doing. They just want to follow in Margaret's footsteps and how is she structuring her first grade literacy block? How is she, what assessments is she using? So I don't know how much we want to get into that, but.
I mean, I think what I can say that would be helpful just for a general frame for any teacher or literacy coach is that what I realized was that I needed to teach the foundational skills in a different way than I was teaching the language comprehension side of things. And once I realized that the foundational skills were best taught using differentiated instruction with a clear scope and sequence and explicit instruction, once I realized I needed objective measures for seeing how well my students were doing, like once I had that on lock, like I had my small group plan, then the language comprehension stuff got to be so much fun. Like that means like rich read aloud text for everybody, and we're all deep in learning, building content knowledge, we're all talking with one another. I feel like that's an area that I struggled a little bit with teaching via Zoom. Like, how do you get the academic conversation going? But in the classroom, it would have felt really awesome. So I think part of what comes down for teachers trying to figure out how to structure their day is like, what am I trying to accomplish? And what is the practice of teaching that is going to get my students there most efficiently? Right? Like, I'm not going to be mixing paint during a phonics lesson, but I'm definitely going to be mixing paint during an art lesson. So I think trying to approach things, I know you're worried, Mark, about approaching things in like a piecemeal kind of way. But I think when teachers really understand why behind the things that they're teaching, then we're able to use the instructional minutes more wisely.
Yeah, I don't want to make any broad complaint here. I mean,
you can go ahead.
No, I don't have one. I do see bad examples. You know, the thing about language and orthography is that they are, all the parts overlap. And so if you decide to teach all the parts separately, that's kind of dividing up the language in a really unnatural way, mm-hmm. and takes a lot more time. And it doesn't take advantage of the connections between different kinds of things. So
and it's less fun for kids.
And it's less fun because you're losing track of the goal and you've divided up into all the components. So I want the cake at the end. I don't want just the recipe and the, you know, focusing on each of the ingredients. Anyway, I have specific concerns about overuse of certain kinds of ideas. And also I'm trying to raise awareness of the need to think about both too little of certain kinds of instruction and too much, because both of those things can happen. Beyond that, you know, we just have to move ahead and develop better programs and better guidelines and take as much advantage of what's been learned and do the kinds of things that you've been engaged in. So yeah, I don't want to complain too hard, really.
The other thing people are thinking about or wondering about is just thinking about assessment time and are there efficient ways to do that? And, you know, how frequently are you doing that? How are you making it a good use of everybody's time? And because mm-hmm. is it just you and with your kids, right? Like it's you don't have aides or anything helping you with that?
Yeah, so I think in terms of assessment, I need to monitor regularly what I've taught that I'm expecting kids to master. So if I've taught something like the spelling sound IGH, then I need to know if the kids actually learned it so I can decide if we're done with reviewing it or if we need more review or if we need reteaching or something. I feel like the assessment on the foundational side of things is actually really easy. It's quick. Like once I found out that oral reading fluency was so important, like I used to feel like, oh, I don't want to push kids to read faster and faster. I was really afraid of the idea of doing an oral reading fluency assessment until I realized that I could do it in a very relaxed, casual way with a kid and get this insight into whether or not they were likely to be able to comprehend text that they were reading to themselves. Like once I started to realize how this is helping me understand how well they've integrated the phonics that I've been teaching them or their phonemic awareness, Like once I started to realize that, I'm like, there are a whole lot of screening tools that take 1 minute to do that can totally boot out the time consuming reading records that I was doing. So that freed up a whole lot more time. I feel like the area where my assessment portfolio is weak, and I actually wonder if it's just because great tools don't exist, is on the language comprehension side of things. So it's very hard for me to monitor the vocabulary development, the syntax that my students are, I can look at their writing, but I don't have a really great way of doing it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think my thoughts are, it's really important because, you know, when people say that their kids are learning, are handling basic skills and they're learning to phonics and all these things, but they're not comprehending texts, I always want to know, well, can they understand the text that is spoken to them?
Right.
And often you find, you know, the child's spoken language comprehension isn't necessarily, they may not be familiar with certain kinds of forms, and they may not know certain words and so on. So here's the thing. Why should you first grade? I talk to a lot of teachers. I get a lot of information. I've certainly looked at a lot of curricula. I don't know exactly, you know, I don't know how much goes on in classrooms, and it varies a lot. But kids come to start school with spoken language, knowledge of spoken language varies enormously. And that's a muscle that needs building. I mean, that's something that itself needs attention, because being able to learn that there are phonemes, being able to learn about how spelling patterns map onto phonemes, phonemic awareness, all these things that people are thinking about as related to reading depend on the kids' knowledge of spoken language.
Yep.
How many words they know, what they know about the structure of speech, whether they know the words well enough to comprehend them. So what about spoken language differences? I mean, are they neglected in instruction? Is it assumed that, yeah, everybody's learned to speak a language by the time they're five, and now, you know, we don't really have to we can focus on print now, we can focus on subject matter, but we don't have to focus on spoken language. Is that
I worry about that. So like, I actually don't have tools to use to assess my students' language comprehension. I've checked in with my school's speech and language pathologist to ask for help in certain instances, and she's very competent and confident in being able to help with this. And I realized that I would love to have a better measure than my gut. So like, for example, I put in a referral for a kiddo because he will do things like say, like, I want that one. I'm like, which one? The star that has the red on it. And I'm like, oh, you want the red star? But whoa, that was a whole lot of work to try to get that out. And you're seven. So I have some concerns about what's going on in terms of your language comprehension and ability to generate language. But I don't have the tools myself to be, other than my gut, to be like, I think something might be up. And that's the way I used to approach the foundational side of things. And there was a much better path forward.
Well, there are parallel sorts of tools. That is, they're short form, they don't take a huge amount of time, but they're about the spoken language production and a comprehension side of things. You know, some of them are really simple things like, I'm not sure they can be done in a group or not. They're logistical things to talk about, but nonetheless, there are definitely sort of these short form ways of the spoken language analogs of what you're describing for reading.
So they could be
employed.
Our homework in this conversation is to put together a list for our dear listeners who are wanting to have some ideas for some of these assessments that Margaret's using or ideas Mark has, and we can put that up on the reading meeting website, I think, for
let's do it.
Yeah, spoken language, it doesn't stop, you know, I mean, it has to continue developing for a very long time. And if the child is learning to read, great. A lot of language development is going to happen because they're reading. But, you know, in the early phases where kids are just getting into reading or some are struggling with reading, often the problem is not really about reading. It's secondary to what they know about the language. And this is why, you know, schools where kids aren't in conversation with kids and between kids is not encouraged, where quiet is really emphasized, where, you know, there's no talking at lunch or or at recess, or if there is recess, or, you know, the classroom is only supposed to be kids responding. Kids need to be able to talk and get use language and spoken language interactively. And that kind of learning has to continue. And if there are kids who are, we know there are kids whose development has not progressed as rapidly as other kids, that's absolutely something that can be addressed. And it's I wonder if it's being neglected.
I think it is. And I think one of the reasons why it's being neglected is too often teachers are sent in the direction of trying to assess foundational skills and comprehension and language comprehension all simultaneously. It's why guided reading has such a stronghold on us. It's why leveled books have such a stronghold on us. Like, we like to think of this, the cohesive model of reading and writing for authentic purposes, but it makes it so that it's very difficult for us to be able to diagnose the cause of the issue. And I think once we actually are empowered to be able to pull apart, I know we're worried about like keeping them apart, but once we're able to pull them apart in order to be able to tease out the issues in order to deliver targeted instruction and to understand our students better, we're actually in a whole lot better shape. It's a lot better than being able to say, like, I know that this kid is a level J reader, which doesn't give you very much of a
point. No, it doesn't. Forward. Yeah. I think emphasize about where the kid is with respect to major components of reading is really crucial. How you then teach them, whether you think of them as independent or not, and whether you can couple different things together, that's a separate issue, okay? But in terms of understanding where's my kid making progress, and if they're not doing well overall, what are the particular strengths and weaknesses they have? You know, you can map out a profile for a kid and target more of this and less of that. So,
and know how we created that issue too, right? Like, if we end up doing assessments on students and we're finding out like the vast majority of our students have difficulty with word recognition, like that's the moment to look at our curriculum and look at our instruction and think through, well, why? Because the fault is not in our kids. What they've learned is the result of what we've taught.
Yeah.
Molly, did you notice how we got back on topic?
And that great. I was like, that was like a good little wrap up, Margaret. Wait a minute.
So what people who have been listening want, what kinds of materials? Because like, we're trying to make good on our promises.
Yeah, I think these assessment things and the recommendations for the quick little 1 minute assessments would be really helpful.
So Margaret, I mean, the basically assessment has a bad reputation because of course everybody was stuck with it and it was overdone. And we're talking about something a little bit different, right? Something that's really closely tied to what you are teaching and what your kids are learning, what the goals are for those, rather than, you know, just being able to find where their strengths and weaknesses are so you can kind of adjust things for them.
Right, it's tracking your teaching as opposed to tracking the kids per se. It's tracking what the impact of your instruction is having.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that was the biggest shift for me was to be able to look at concrete data points and to be able to see, this is the result of my efforts. Yeah. That was, I mean, really scary when what you see is data in front of you who are like, I'm struggling right now and I need help. Versus being able to look at it and be like, I'm seeing budges on certain measures. Why? What am I doing that's causing that? And being able to look at the curriculum that I was delivering and be able to see the consequences of it. It's a lot.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. Thank you so
well,
much.
Well, thank you. And I guess we should really let you go back. Thank you so much for your
I gotta
clarity.
Get ready for tomorrow. The kids are coming.
I understand.
Exciting.
I gotta get ready for tomorrow because I got a few things that are overdue. But I hope you have a
Molly,
good,
why do you have to get ready for tomorrow?
Waiting
because
for
time. Anyway, have a good day tomorrow and a good week. And thank you again for talking with us and for people who've written in things on the chat. We'll really try to collate them and follow up with some more details.
Yeah. Think about your questions, because next weekend we're going to be here, just me and Mark taking questions. So get those real toughies ready for us.
Next week is Ask Me Anything.
Yeah.
Or us. Okay. Have a really great rest of the day and week. And thanks again for talking to you.
Bye, you guys. Good to talk with you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this reading meeting recording. You can find more information about past and future reading meetings on our website. We hope you'll join us for future meetings.